All right, you guys ready?
Yep.
All right, welcome everybody. This is Travis from the Renegade HPG podcast, and we are back with another roundtable with my guests.
Hi, I'm Alex Iglesias, aka Flying Debris. I draw lots of mechs.
Hi, I'm Brent. I do the On the Origin of Valmex podcast with some guys from the Wolfnet community. We've been going for about 6 months now and starting to put everything on YouTube. It's
Excellent.
fun project. I enjoy it.
What's your YouTube channel, Brent? I haven't seen it pop up on there.
Same name.
Okay.
So On the Origin of Valmex podcast.
When did you start that? Because I know I've searched it before, but I didn't find it. I just
like
found the
3 weeks ago.
Oh, that's why. Okay.
Yeah.
Super new.
Like,
all right.
Very recent.
Everybody, hop on over On the Origin Valmex on YouTube and let's get some subscribers over to those guys. But yeah, this, and we have Bishop, who once again is stuck on island time in Mexico. Maybe he'll join us, maybe he won't, but we're gonna run without. So we have Alex, who very modestly said he draws mechs. He's probably drawn more mechs than any other person in the world at this point, because almost solely professionally. Well, all right, let's nominate. Who do you think has maybe drawn more battle mechs than you? Like, legit ones. Not like not doodles, but like these are like legit used out there.
Oh, I don't know. There's a lot of other mech artists out there. I don't want to claim that.
All right. Well, I'll claim it.
Wouldn't be fair.
All right. Certainly the one recognizable these days. Maybe like something like Dana Knudsen or something.
How about you're in the Pantheon?
There you go. You're up there. You're up there.
Okay, sure. I'll take that, I guess.
But we this is going to be our mech panel, and so last podcast we had Tex Bruins and Bishop, who are kind of the historians, and we've got a really awesome panel coming up for the third one, which I'll save as a kind of surprise for the people to kind of find out once that comes out. But this is going to be a very mech centric podcast, so we have Alex, who's drawn them a lot of them, redesign them, and actually has to do it in a practical sense that is applied in the online gaming. And so things have to actually work in a program. They can't just be cool looking on a paper. And then Brent, who's spent many, many, many hours talking about where these mechs came from. Some good perspectives, and we're going to dive in. And so, no, first, we were talking about this a little bit before we started, but, the one that I had kind of on the schedule for the last one, and didn't get to, because I definitely wanted to get Alex in for it, but was talking about weapon variants and the varieties between manufacturers. And, I don't know where your guys' knowledge on the lore side. I know Bishop was the one who could kind of spit out, every type of medium laser or PPC based on the manufacturer and when it was built, and maybe we'll get him on in a little bit. But in the meantime, I think the key thing that I was interested in is kind of exploring is just like, how do we think these weapons work? I mean, people talk about ACs, is it a single round? Is it multiple rounds? How do they function? What are the calibers? And even with lasers too, and kind of lasers is the one that, I kind of have thought about the most, is that, we have small laser, medium laser, large laser, but I feel like it's like there's the instinct is maybe to think that it's just one type of laser that everyone builds. And I think it's more like everyone builds a completely different laser, and just whatever damage class that happens to produce, is kind of where it gets decided whether it's a small, medium, or large. But yeah, I'm curious, Alex, in terms of actually having to design those and put those on mechs, if you have any thoughts on kind of that function of variety, and if you actually distinguish one type of medium laser from another.
In terms of just making artwork, normally that stuff doesn't quite fall into my area. Normally it's just like, oh, I'm just drawing some weapon effect on a cover or what have you. But I do think about some of this stuff just for personal, fan reasons and such. I think my understanding is that, like, a lot of the weapons, it's they're only like the classification is about as specific as saying something like assault rifle or a tank
pistol
cannon.
Or shotgun,
yeah, like there's all sorts of you know, BattleTech is a big setting. There's no reason to expect that all of these weapons would be built along the exact same blueprint with the exact same, you know, performance characteristics. That, you know, a lot of the stuff, you know, for the sake of abstraction, for the sake of tabletop rules, and not, you know, taking 3 hours for one turn, you know, a lot of the stuff is necessarily glossed over. But, you know, I would say fluff wise, there's a good argument to be made for considerable performance differences. With lasers, I'm not, you know, too familiar with some of the differences between them. I know that there's some brands like Lushan Red Beam, which is like a large laser that is known for going on, I think, the Bulldog tank, and it's apparently an extremely rugged design. I know that there is a brand called the Cyclops Eye that I think goes on, I want to say the Goblin or the Condor. It was like one of the hover tanks that apparently uses some sort of mixture of, you know, PPC technology and large laser technology to, you know, actually essentially be like a halfway PPC / large laser, although this has almost no effect on the stats, but it's just like this little fluff footnote in the TRO. I think the large laser on the Wyvern is supposed to somehow, apparently it's powerful, extremely tough, and somehow interacts with like the small laser that is mounted in that same arm somehow. I think there's also like some notable example of like, I think the medium laser that is mounted on, I want to say the Hermes, that apparently has something to the effect of, if it misses, it doesn't fire, but it still generates the heat rules wise, but at least it doesn't like put wear and tear on the firing mechanism.
Right.
So it almost activates like a streak in that respect, but you know, you're not gonna notice it rules wise, but like fluff wise, it's right. Basically, you know, it only fires when it hits.
It makes me think, you know, when people talk about kind of the armor and kind of breaching the armor and how the weapons go, like my original thought was like, you know, you've got 20 points of chest armor on this mech and you've got to get through all 20 points of chest armor, and then there's no chest armor anymore, and then you kind of breach. And the more I thought about it, the more I was like, that doesn't make sense at all.
No, it just
makes sense of like, it's like 20 is like the average, you know, right? Is that, you know, it's like statistically, once you've got 20 points of damage spread out over the course of that, there's still armor coverage, but it's more like, you know, your next shot statistically has a good chance of kind of hitting one of those damage points and breaching, you know, into the armor and kind of going through. And then it makes a little bit more of that, you know, rolling the two and getting that insta crit, you know, or possible insta crit, you know, in there, because it's more just about kind of finding the breach points and not necessarily about clearing the armor off a section. And so you know, that was like my personal like duh epiphany of like, oh, whoa, you're not clearing the armor. You're just creating enough breaches where, you know, good chance your next shot is going through a place that you already hit. But yeah, that was a fun little revelation there.
There was actually a rule system I've seen posted online. It was like essentially someone had created a set of like a house rules package that used the damage system from, I think, a pre-BattleTech FASA game called Renegade Legion. And they somehow mated the Renegade Legion armor rules into being able to work with BattleTech. And the way that the Renegade Legion armor rules were that instead of a location having X many points and you had to get through each and every one to get to armor underneath, like in BattleTech, they had it where the number of points of armor essentially created a grid, and the weapons were templates that would cut out of the grid almost like Tetris pieces kind of stuff.
Okay.
And some of the templates would actually be like T-shaped, for example, where if they went in, it would divorce armor from the surface. Because like if a grid location couldn't trace all the way back to the internals, it was considered divorced armor, so it would just shed away. So if you had something like an LBX sandblasting, you get like a whole bunch of one squares, you know, kind of evenly removed or whatever. But if you had something like a solid autocannon hit, it was usually like some sort of T shape, so it would like punch and like shed all sorts of armor off of the surface, yeah. So other stuff could penetrate more easily.
Yeah,
and I think they changed it to where the crits, you no longer rolled for crits. It was more like all of the crit locations were just dotted into a portion of your internal HP.
Okay,
so you just kind of like work your way through the armor into the internals and try to like almost like you sunk my battleship type situation, you know, try and take out those particular slots. I have no idea. I've never played with the system. I just thought it was a very fascinating rule set. I have no idea, but I imagine it would make the turns take forever and a half.
No, I'm kidding.
But I would love to be wrong on that.
Well, at least I know where that name is, because I was like thinking about names at some point I need to, you know, if I'm bringing in enough, you know, income, if I'm selling shirts or something for Renegade HPG, I need some business set up. And I was like, Renegade Legion Games, that sounds good. And then it was taken. I was like, damn it. That was such a good name. I love the name Legion in general. Like, it is a good name. And I was like, oh man. I was like, whenever I have a business idea, I go straight to domain registration. And if the domain's open, I can run with it. If not, it's dead on arrival. But, you know, it's nice to know that there's some of these creativity, you know, coming out of that lost domain opportunity. Mm-hmm. But, Brent, go ahead.
Well, that system sounds really neat. And it sounds like what they're trying to do is kind of square peg round hole the BattleTech armor with real world armor, because BattleTech armor obviously is ablative, as we have discussed. We just haven't used that term. And real world armor is, you know, you either penetrate or you don't. It's a pass fail. Yeah. So that's a cool way to do that. I think that's really neat, but definitely something that needs to be put into Megamech to try it out. Otherwise, you'll be having it like a game would last a weekend.
Yeah, potentially.
Yeah.
What was the autocannons that we had brought up before we started recording, mm-hmm. Alex, that you were kind of all in? And Brent, you know, let's dive into that, because I definitely kind of try to put that on the
back burner. Oh, I love autocannons.
All right, let's talk autocannons.
I mean, my understanding of autocannons, and it's, you know, obviously their ratings, because a autocannon built on Hesperus 2 is not going to be the same as a autocannon built on, you know, New Avalon.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be a differences, whether it be like metallurgical or just processing, like not to mention ammunition variants and all of that. So like obviously they're brackets, and my understanding of reading the lore is that they send out a burst, but they tend to be small numbers of bursts, so like 3 to 5 shots, and they tend to mechanically, at least because it's a game and we want to have the games actually finish, you know, they group together as a single shot, and it's a rules thing. And, you know, that's been my read on it, at least, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, like, also same. Like, from mostly this is just from either, you know, skimming like 10-year-old BattleTech threads where people have been like poring over every page from the novels, or, you know, going over multiple TRO entries and stuff. But like there are like a few interesting things that do kind of pop up Like, I think, for instance, Imperator, like, certain brands are definitely tied to certain factions or, you know, regions. Like, not 100%, because there's always, like, that cross-pollination because of salvage and, you know, who knows what else. But
black market's a thing.
Yeah. But, like, you do have some things like, for instance, the Imperator line of autocannons, like Imperator Z, Imperator A, B, so on and so forth. You see examples of them on, like, the Urban Mech, the Rifleman, the King Crab. From what I've been able to glean, they technically all use the same exact caliber. I think it was actually mentioned in one of the novels where Yenlo Wang was fighting on Solaris, that, like, the Imperator on the Urban Mech is literally firing just twice as many rounds as the Imperators on the Rifleman. And yeah, apparently they're all 80 millimeter, which it makes for, like, an interesting standpoint, because if you think about it, if, like, that could actually very much be a brand bonus, you know, if you're using Imperator auto cannons, whether it's a 10 or a 20 or a 5, I don't know about the 2s, I have no idea, because I don't think that was ever actually listed, and it seems to have a different naming structure. They call it the Smoothie 2 or whatever. Yeah, like, it would make logistically things so much easier.
That's interesting.
You just needed to have one type of ammo that you just stick in the bins for.
Yeah, so it's just
your guns.
So you guys are saying it's fire rate that separates from 5, 10, and 20. It's about the bullets are the same. You
know, at least on the Imperator brand, yeah.
Okay.
At least on the Imperator brand, it's literally a matter of fire rate, and, like, the bigger ones, just, I guess, because of higher fire rate, are less accurate, so that kind of limits the ability to reach, and also shorter barrels, I guess.
Yeah.
But, like, you also have some stuff like the ChemJet 185 millimeter that is on the Demolisher and the Monitor Blue Navy, you know, patrol craft, that apparently are, like, don't actually function like most of the other autocannons. They have some sort of weird binary chemical propulsion where they just kind of mix the chemicals together to make the propulsion on the fly instead of using an actual, you know, casing like you would expect.
Mm-hmm.
So weird. It's like, yeah, it's almost like a weird caseless autocannon without actually
What's the projectile then? Is it, like, kind of like a musket ball? You know, and the propellant is separate?
Well, you'd essentially have the, you know, just the warhead itself, and you'd be firing that.
Yeah.
And, like, the propulsion would just be kind of almost like an internal combustion engine, just kind of jetted in there, and then boom. And just based off of that description, it seems to imply, like, a slow fire rate with a big shell.
Going back to the autocannons being a standardized on the Impara or Imara, what was the line?
Imperator.
So that actually makes a lot of sense, because when you think about the tonnage of the ammo, you know, like, it scales down by 2. So if you're firing twice as many shots, one ton of ammo is going to give you that many rounds.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That makes sense. And then that going to that kind of standardization, I mean, your clip is the same. You put the same clip in no matter what,
that detail is, like, I think, just from what I've seen, is just particular to that particular brand. But, like, auto cannons are kind of, like, all over the place.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
I think another notable brand would be, like, the Midron line that is common on, like, Jaeger mechs. I think on the Champion as well. I'm not sure what else, but they seem to be, like, mostly a Davion affiliated brand, but like at least for the I think D and C models, which were like the AC2 and AC5 classes, they seem to be like, you know, what you would expect like anti-aircraft guns to be, because they're mounted on the Jaeger mech. So probably, you know, something high velocity, high rate of fire, you know, probably small individual caliber, so just, you know, kind of fire rate.
Clean up a wall.
Yeah, wall of lead. Oh,
yep.
Well, there we go.
We have Bishop.
Bishop is joining us. That's white
person. Maybe, maybe not. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Hear you.
I can hear you.
Can't see you though.
Can't see you yet. There we go.
There we go.
He has appeared.
Excellent. One thing at a time. Yeah, y'all doing?
We're doing good.
Good.
Apologies for being the bad Mexican stereotype about always late, mañana. But
no worries. Like I said, you're on island time down there. That's all it is.
Anyhow,
we got you now. We got you now. So we were wrapping up. We were wrapping our discussion about auto cannons. We were talking about caliber and burst fire and, you know, standard clip. And Alex was giving us a little background on the Imperator auto cannon, how it's fairly standardized. And I think that was the extent. We didn't know of too many auto cannons. And while I was looking it up on Sarna while Alex was talking, it looks like there's maybe only two mechs with auto cannons that might fire a single round, which would be the Gargoyle and the Cauldron Born.
Yeah. 203 millimeter. 203 millimeter. Yep. There was one or two other possibles, and then the Chemjet's a double shot, so not a long burst, but two shot. If I remember correctly, for the Demolisher. Yeah.
Okay.
Demolisher.
I didn't know it was two shot.
There's a few of those that are like that. I'm actually the one that fixed. Oh. I can give you two more examples. They're the ones that I actually put on the Sarna side, unless they changed it. The Enforcer and the Hatchetman are both single shot. You can tell from reading the lore specifically, it states 10 round magazines on it and was put in there. And so when you read the context on it, it's a single shot autocannon. And then they use that same technology on the Hatchetman for the 10 shot clips.
Okay. Right.
But
I think the AC-20 on the Saladin hovercraft is also a single shot, because I think that one is also 200 something.
Yeah, it's something ridiculous like that.
So that's that just seems like it's that's got to be a logistical nightmare to have different autocannons that fire different kinds of clips and need their own ammunition. My goodness.
Well, yeah, it's kind of a logistical nightmare to have like a
more than one
crapshoot of different chassis. Yeah.
Wait, you mean 500 active combat chassis doesn't cause problems? Yeah. Not counting variants?
Yeah, it's like people all do their lance builds on Facebook, and I'm like, you know, I need to build a medium lance, and I was like, oh well, pick a mech and then take four of them, and then you got realist.
I get the whole joy of 30-25 rule of cool, plus you're taking what you can get. So you're like the Banana Republic guy getting the Russian scraps and the Egyptians milsurp and all that. And you can't be, but I always love it. Like when people are doing, I'm doing a campaign and like, oh, my rifleman's running low on ammo. Okay, great. So, hey, we just blew up this other mech with a AC-5. Yes, but that one has 120 millimeter AC-5, and you have 75 millimeter.
Oh man, that is some intense GMing right there. I love it.
Well, I mean, the abstract's great for the gameplay, but for the RPG and the campaign play, to me, it just doesn't work. Oh, look, my interchangeable Lego ammo.
Yeah,
doesn't work that way.
Actually, it's something that's been that Merc Tech mod has been like going rather in depth on in terms of like calibers and, you know, like I think apparently one of the most cross compatible calibers is actually 120 millimeter, because like you have it on the GM Whirlwind autocannon, the one that's on the Marauder. 120
is that
millimeter
Wolverine also?
You know what? I think it is. Yeah.
Okay.
And I believe the GM Whirlwind is known for firing 3-shot bursts. Mm-hmm. And then, like, I think the 120 millimeter round also shows up on, like, certain AC-10 models and a bunch of AC-20 models as well. But, yeah.
Yeah. And then it's just would be the longer burst, because I remember the first time I saw any of the authors address it, I think it was Stackpole, where he just was like, the Rifleman has 5-shot pop guns. The Centurion had a 10-shot, or the Urban Mech in the same novel, a 10-shot pop gun. You know, it was like, we're just each one had extra shots, but it was, yeah, a little silly in that regard, or simplistic, I guess I should say, not silly.
Well, the one thing that strikes me weird is like the barrel size. You know, you look at something like a, you know, a Rifleman or even a Centurion, and then you have like a Hunchback, and it's like, how does that work? You know, what's that, how's that work in your brain? Like, how do you get something shooting, you know, AC-20 out of a muzzle that's what, like 2 meters?
That had to really, realistically, that would had to have been like a rotary cannon inside that short barrel, yeah. Multi. Only way something like that remotely makes sense. Or,
yeah.
Well, I guess if you're going to go with the short range, it's like the old, what is it, the carronades the battleships had that were the little short barreled, yeah, short range. Okay. You know, black powder things. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, Alex, I mean, were you thinking about that, Alex? Because you have a Hunchback in like in the assembly plane or something that has like two, like a rotary one on it. Am I remembering?
Isn't
that right?
The Quasimodo actually that was disassembled, yeah, with the laser?
Oh no, it's got an Ultra AC-10, so it had like a, okay, 4-barrel, okay, kind of thing there. But yeah, like for some of that really cavernous housing that you see on like some of the 3060 mechs, especially, like the only way it makes sense, especially since some of the round sizes are like 50 millimeter when you got like an opening, you know, that you, yeah, can literally do jumping jacks in. It makes sense if it's basically just sort of a big housing for, like Bishop said, a multi-barrel type thing, or if you have some sort of like internal gimballing kind of thing as well. Like if, say, you wanted to have the weapon like adjust at range without necessarily
running the
entire torso, like
the arm,
like having something where, you know, if the opening is over here for the gun and like the back end is over here, having the back end be able to like, you know, move a little bit while the front end is kind of held mostly in place, yeah, to adjust, yeah, the angle slightly, then maybe that makes some sort, yeah, of sense.
So we do actually see that. I believe it's with the Shadowhawk, one of the versions, one of the early TROs specifically talks about how it has that gimbal over the shoulder and that increases, mm-hmm, the accuracy.
Yeah. And obviously you got to have some type of tumbler or something, or even on lasers, yeah, because there's no way you're going to have them straight line in line with the torso and able to hit,
no,
anything in combat.
No. No,
well, that's like, that always
like
bugged me
every,
too. It's like
everything has an internal stabilizer. It would have to. It just doesn't look that way in the art, because, mm-mm, how do you portray that? Literally asking the artist, how do you portray that in the art? You know?
Yeah, that always got me, because it was like whenever it looks fixed, I was like, is it look like the mechs are having a seizure on there because they keep like drifting based on where they came in.
I got to get my AC-20
over here, yeah, and then I got to get my Elrond.
So my like little kind of hand wavy head cannon on that is when you see like the laser port, is you have the built-in system that ports out to like maybe just a little bit of fiber optic or some sort of slightly malleable material that will conduct the wavelength through it, and then, mm-hmm, you have the lens actually on a little gimbal that has, you know, can shoot around and gets you 30 degrees to one, yeah, side or the other.
Yeah.
Because otherwise,
well, that's
so
how
many
they're
of
done
the weapon systems
on tumblers in reality.
Yeah.
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 I mean, we've all seen the videos of those tank tests where they pour a pint on a little platform at the end of the weapons platform and then drive up and down the, mm-hmm, hillside. You know. But,
I was
we already have that tech.
Yeah.
Now, one autocannon, other thing I always thought, like, you look at the Centurion, it's one of the famous ones, the arm with that massive sleeve. Dragon also, especially the Dragon, huge sleeve and an AC-5.
I love
My thought was, so is that possibly a free-floated barrel shroud of armor so that it can do things like punch and not knock the autocannon out of alignment?
Yeah.
Whatnot. So
well,
it's,
that's,
you know,
that's a whole different world. It's like, how the hell are these mechs hitting each other and not destroying their weapons? Like, well, this Marauder punched me, at least it doesn't get to use that PPC anymore.
Well, real world, I had people get their panties in a twist on the Facebook forums when I even had commented, realistically, a mech punching would crush its hands after the first couple punches. Yeah. The armor would shatter pretty quickly, and even if you had full metal Terminator-type gimbaled fingers, that compared to what it's hitting, I've worked heavy construction equipment most of my early adult life. Even at low speed, heavy equipment running into other heavy equipment does very, very ugly things to both pieces of equipment.
Well, man, so, think about one human punching another human. It's like those boxers have gloves for a reason. You know, it's like it only takes, you know, one punch to break your knuckles, break your hand.
Which is why I wish they had much, again, abstract rules, but everyone today I see plays, oh, let's drop ammo, run to the middle of the map, and start kicking and punching. And it's like, yeah, you know, in actual military combat, melee combat would be like the last resort.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, my first, when I picked back up Battletech back in early 2019, the first in-person game I had with somebody was just somebody I'd met online, and we met up at a store. He was a nice guy, but he just went straight and ran up with his 3 mechs to my Stalker and started kicking him, and my kept falling down, and I was just like, well, this is no fun. And one, aren't your legs broken by now? It's like you keep kicking my Stalker.
Like, it would make for a much stronger demand for actual melee weapons and stuff, especially like the sword, for example. Yeah. If, you know, rolling to punch and you actually connect had a chance of like critting out your hand or something like that.
Yeah.
Or like messing up the weapons mounted in your arm if you didn't have a hand, or, you know, like just degradation of that respect. But like also that kind of creates more bookkeeping in, you know, a tabletop game that's supposed to be like representing about, I don't know, what, a few minutes worth of fighting, I guess.
Right.
So, yeah, every round's 10 seconds. So, I mean, there is that abstract, but there's just something that just, it hits me wrong when you read, like, in any of the forums, the Charger's a great mech because you can charge! You have an $8 million machine, and you're using it as a battering ram.
Yeah.
And you think this somehow is a good idea.
Yeah.
Well, another guy, I used to actually do a campaign mechanic, because I had a guy that would try to abuse that with Savannah Masters. He'd, like, buy a bunch and do, like, I have 20 Savannah Masters. They're all going to suicide charge. And so I started hitting his mercenary reputation, one, known for killing his pilots, and two, there was only 2,000 of those engines out there total. So I started kind of keeping track. I'm like, nah, there's no more Savannah Masters on the market, buddy. Sorry.
You used up all those tiny microfusion engines.
All those Omni 20s, I think they were, or whatever they were. Yeah. As like, just the amount of, I get, for your local game, one-off pick-em-ups, it's do whatever for fun, but it seems like that's become the norm in so much the community now, of how they view the game. Well, why would you build a mech with this under the other thing? Doesn't matter if it makes sense to put stealth armor on it and fluff, it doesn't help it in the game mechanics. Okay, whatever.
Well, the question is, how granular do you want to get? And I think that's something that a lot of groups fall prey to, not having that conversation. You know, someone wants to get super granular. Someone just wants to roll some dice and have fun.
Yeah.
Both are absolutely valid, but you have to find a way to mesh it so everybody's having fun.
Yeah. Yep.
And well, I mean, like, also, it's a completely different play style because these things aren't real. I mean, when we read the fiction, you read them about, you know, weaving in and out of tree lines, shooting PPC shots and LRM volleys at long range and falling back and conserving ammo and armor, because these are million C-bill machines that are exceedingly hard to replace, and mm-hmm. you don't just run forward and go punch, you know?
Unfortunately, some of that I also blame on the clan invasion era, where it went from resource scarce to everybody's building in many assault mechs that they can and just throwing waves and waves, and it became the constant regiment versus regiment. It wasn't just Tukaya, that was just like the beginning.
Yeah.
After that, everything was mass scale. And it was like, all right, I mean, that has its appeal also narratively, makes some sense. But it then veers so far off from the mechanics that started the game that you start running into the gaps or the things that they didn't think about, because the original mechanics were never intended for that level of warfare.
Well, what have you found is like the most practical way to kind of, you know, get into, have your game and have it, you know, thematic, you know, and kind of make sense a little bit in the real world without going like super granular? Like, is it, you know, what's the most basic mechanism for like keeping track of your pilots and keeping track of your salvage? You know, maybe each of you start out with a battalion and whatever, you know, it's like you have these objectives, and if you lose a mech in this one, then you don't ever get it back, something like that. So what's the like simplest way for like a casual player to kind of set something like that up without spending 8 hours reading, you know, the
casual player? I will say from the start, I'm going to say one of the, that is, as much as I don't really enjoy Alpha Strike, at least for smaller unit, that's where it does at least come in handy in mm-hmm. some areas, because you have a lot less record keeping. Because the current setup, when you have to start getting to interstellar operations, tactical operations, strategic operations to keep track of everything. We went from having in 2002, the BattleTech Compendium, which had 95% of all the rules you needed, and then Mercenary Handbook had the rest if you wanted to do the organizational record keeping, to now we have, what is it, 5 or 6 base core rule books at about $50 a pop that, I'm going to say this, sorry, Ray, sorry, Herb, sorry, Brent, and all the CGL guys, but the layouts suck. The bloat is terrible. You don't need logorrhea verbose explanations for every single mechanic on every single page, with half the page wasted by bad graphics to begin with. I mean, one of the biggest things I think that we want to get back to getting the players in fast, simplify the core rule books, period, even in CBT, back to where I can spend $100 and have everything I need to actually start playing the damn game.
Yeah, well, fortunately, things like the compendium aren't even expensive. Those aren't the pricey ones on eBay, so your new player.
Well, yeah, but that's not the current game
stuff. Just grab the old one and play it.
True, but the goal I would think would be to try to get in a position where we're supporting the new game. And mm-hmm. I think one of the biggest mistakes, not just CGL or FanPro made, but when RPGs started hitting the rocks and the skids when the video games came around after 2000, taking a lot of the market, is they just thought more books was more sales. And now it's actually raised the entry barrier so high that it's actually very unappealing to a lot of players to get in. Wait, I have to spend $250 just on the core books? And that's without a TRO? That's without a map? That's without any miniatures? I mean, now we have the box set for $50, which is pretty good. Yeah. But there's so much not in that, especially if you want to learn combined arms.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we don't have a current rule set that is, in my opinion, especially new player friendly for doing the bookkeeping for a mercenary unit, for doing that stuff. Go look back at the 1E Mercenary Handbook. It was extremely simple to keep track of stuff, to build a unit, to record keep for the unit in between, do the upkeep in between. You look at the new stuff, you got to jump between 3 different books even to find all the rules you need to do it.
Yeah.
And that's for construction. That's for unit maintenance. That's for unit logistics. And frankly, that's a bass-ackward way to build the entire system, in my opinion. So, anyhow, I'll shut up now so that Brent and Alex can go. Rant's over.
We'll get back into talking mechs and talking about obscure mech things. You had missed also, Bishop, we were talking about lasers and the difference, you know, what classified as lasers. And I was saying how it just seems like it's, you know, you just decide how much damage does your laser do, and that's going to determine whether it's a medium, a small, or a large But we didn't talk about like color. You know, I always get people, especially on the miniature, they're like, what color is this laser? What color is that laser? And I think it's, the answer is whatever you want to tune it to. You know,
Skittles.
For one, you're not going to see it in the first place if it's an actual laser to work it the way. But if
I mean, you could have, like, I guess, if you wanted to, but
it's a very foggy battlefield. You know, maybe if it's something
like that. I mean, you probably wouldn't, like, realistically, you probably wouldn't even see any particular color for the lasers. Because it's not very efficient to put, you know, a military.
You can add wavelength, but why would you? And like you say, it's not efficient. You're bleeding off actual power throughput to the burning capability of the laser by going to the color spectrums to get the pretty colors. So, yeah,
white
visually,
is though, color.
Visually, I always like to go, you know, small lasers red, medium lasers green, large lasers blue.
Blue.
Purely because of MechWarrior 2 Mercenaries. That's how they had it.
Yep.
And that's just, that's my tradition that I like to carry forth. You know.
Amen. Amen.
But, yeah, like, I do think, though, at the energy levels that, you know, your typical battle tech laser would be operating at, you know, megawatt range or what have you, I think you'd probably see some sort of ionization going on in the atmosphere. So there would probably be something visual, but, like, I don't think it would be, like, you know, a taste the rainbow type scenario when a mech opened up on you. It'd probably just be, like, a bunch of maybe, like, white or heat shimmers or something.
Yeah. Some more would come out. I mean, 30 seconds into the most battles, you're going to have smoke contrails and stuff like that, which if you cross that, you'll get something. Yeah. But like you say, yeah, it's not going to be rainbow bright. You're going to, whatever it is, and I'm not a laser physicist, so I don't know what the hottest quote-unquote bandwidth or wavelength is, but probably almost all of them are going to be some form of that with just different levels of power pumping.
Well, it seems, if you think about that in the real world and on the battlefield, that seems so much more scary than if you're like, you're an infantryman running around and then, you know, suddenly your buddy gets hit by a large laser. You see the blue beam come and take him out versus you're just running around and then all of a sudden your buddy just disintegrates next to you and you saw nothing other than your buddy just melt. And you're like, that seems way more scary.
One of the big fears that they voiced with military lasers also is for infantry use as a blinding device.
Yep.
You have no idea what's going on. Some type of laser mine goes off with no visible beams, approximately eye level, and your platoon is now all blinded by high-intensity lasers that nobody saw, nobody could track.
I don't know if this has been, like, corroborated. I only, like, read it in one place. But apparently, I think when Saddam Hussein's military was fighting against Iran's military, like, I think, in the 80s, I want to say, I'm not 100% sure. Apparently he had like his tanks basically aim their laser range finders and just sweep the Iranian positions. And like, apparently it caused thousands of instances of blindness. Like just sweeping range finders because the range finders were strong enough to cause, you know, lasting eye damage. I watched this kid on YouTube. His name is his username is like Styropyro or something like that, and like he's like some 17 or 18 year old kid that just kind of builds these ridiculously overpowered laser systems by like buying stuff online and retrofitting, you know, existing lasers with like bigger capacitors and all this stuff.
Oh man, the glory of YouTube.
And like, yeah, like one of the things he mentions is like, yeah, if you so much as look at these lasers without the proper goggles, you know, you're gonna be blind. That's just end of story. And like, it's not even looking at the aperture, it's not even having it shown in your eyes, it's like looking at the focal point, you know, is probably enough to like cause lasting eye damage. Mm-hmm. So like, I mean,
flash welding contacts to your eyes is a thing, you know, like when you're stick welding. Mm-hmm. It's same concept.
Well, how strong even like are those keychain lasers? And some of those can cause actual permanent eye damage. And those are barely any power going to those stupid things. Yeah. Now imagine putting a large prismatic ball of some sort or prism system that on a track vehicle like a tank with a full battery power, and think about how many thousands of those little beams you could scatter out across an enemy infantry entrenchment.
Yeah.
And my next question is, what soundtrack are they playing to the disco ball?
Disco Inferno, baby.
Yeah. Like if
well,
you
I've
had
got
like
all your... the I've got all the MechWarrior 2 ones uploaded on the channel now, so people are gonna blast that in the background.
Your typical BattleTech, like, you know, conflict, if you're not wearing laser safety goggles or something to that effect, if you're looking anywhere near that battlefield, you're probably gonna be blind. Just
yeah.
How many medium lasers are being shot every which way?
Even think how much with the sheer radiation output, and again, you get a near pass by enough of those lasers, how much radiation is your body absorbing? Is that going to give you cancer? even on that type of thing.
Grayson Carlisle died from PPC exposure when his hatch was blown off, or they couldn't get it shut. I can't remember. It's been over a decade since I read that book.
Was it that, or I thought his reactor was breached? But I remember it was something, one of those things.
Something
yeah.
like that. But I mean, I just talked about PPCs. One of the things I would love to see if they ever do a redux of the rules to like rebalance the sort of stuff is actually have the like effects of a PPC that we read about in the fiction.
The ECM stuff.
Yeah.
And the kinetic damage versus the burn damage of the lightning strike.
Yeah. Yeah. Because like you read about that stuff and it sounds awesome and scary. And it just, to me at least, doesn't translate mechanically to the table.
I mean, I love my PPCs, but you're right. There's nothing that makes them stand out. Now, and even stuff like Gauss rifles, you read about how the prototype ones had so much recoil that one hunchback they were testing it on in the DCMS kept knocking over from it.
They had to bump against buildings and then just knocked over buildings.
Someone did a miniature of that where it looks like it's tipping over.
But is there any, equal opposite reaction? You should be then with any Gauss rifle doing a PSR even at 15 damage because you're getting hit so hard and fast, shouldn't you? If it has that much recoil on the mech side?
That's assuming that you don't have like some kind of compensator, kind of shock absorber.
And also it depends on the how much mass you're moving, you know, because if
mass velocity
mv squared, you know, if you can get that velocity up higher than or counterweight, there's a whole bunch of math there. So
well, let's face it, first most broken part with the Gauss rifle is the one heat.
I agree.
Watch any railgun fire. Those things should be 8 to 10 heat easily, which also would magically kind of balance them against the AC-20 and other weapons.
The low heat makes sense if, like, you know, the whole low heat is based off of the idea that these things are constantly recharging, like a car battery hooked up to an alternator kind of thing.
To a capacitor. Thing is, when you dump that much electricity, it causes heat, unavoidable.
Exactly.
And friction causes heat. The plasma behind it, it doesn't matter if that plasma cloud is created from a chemical explosion of an autocannon round or from the air friction causing the air to ignite behind it, you still have a plasma cloud in the barrel of a railgun behind it when you fire. That's why whenever you see the Navy do it, you see that huge fireball behind the railguns when they fire off the armature. That's going to cause heat, plain and simple. There's no way to avoid it. Fire in your barrel at extreme plasma is going to equal heat, just like the explosion of an autocannon round causes heat from that.
My understanding is that that's not what you're describing.
Gauss rifles and railguns are different.
Yeah.
Yes and no. Gauss rifles are technically a coil gun, and yet you have the Von Ryan railgun, for instance, on the Yen Lo Wang, which is a Gauss rifle. So Gauss rifles kind of cover both.
Yeah.
It's just an abstract.
They're the same branch of the weapons tree. But
if memory serves, coil guns technically are much less efficient than railguns, and they generally can't get the same type of velocities out of them, which is why the military is looking at rail guns instead of coil guns, which is the other part where you can see the 1980s misunderstanding of science in the Gauss rifle to begin with. because they use the least efficient version of a electromagnetic gun.
The problem with rail guns, though, is rail erosion, which does cause major problems once you start scaling it up. And
part of that is from heat. But the problem is coils, you're still dumping massive amounts of electricity. And if you're getting the same velocity on that projectile, you're still causing the same air friction. You're still going to end up with the same plasma flail, regardless on which way you're doing.
I don't disagree. I do think Gauss rifles should definitely be hotter. And even if you are, say, recharging the thing based off of like a passive trickle charge, the only way you could really justify like a one heat, expenditure, I guess, would be like if you were only firing once every like 10 rounds have passed or something like that.
Something, yeah.
But like if you're recharging this thing and you could fire every single round, there's really nothing to distinguish the high heat dump of like reactor power or whatever from something like a PPC or other energy weapon. So
where do you guys think that energy goes? Because I have not seen anything in the fiction about where they actually dump that current.
Because they have to go somewhere. Because you either have to have a series of coils where it's going in conjunction, or the rails where it's going to, the projectile forms the actual connection and runs the current through. And yeah, they don't get into that really at all. I mean, I guess vaguely they semi-stack pull talk about it. Anything you can put down the board fires, but it's like, it's very hand wavium. But
yeah, like really there should be any mech that has a Gauss rifle should have this cord running down the back of one of its legs. That's the ground,
The other question I would have is, with that much magnetism, and this is just me wondering, I'm not saying it should or not, but if you're having enough magnetism going through that series of coils to launch that projectile, shouldn't almost anything else ferrous around be like getting drawn towards your weapon?
I'm wondering.
If it's, obviously it has to be close. I'm not saying like a mech on the other side of another hex away would get sucked to you, but you think like if you held a spoon a meter away from a Gauss rifle and fire it, I'm kind of curious, because that's a lot of magnetic field being formed.
Probably, but that does raise something that I thought would have been really cool. Like, if anyone ever, like, does some sort of, visual for, say, mag scan, vision mode or whatever, one of the things I thought would be really, really cool is that aside from the signature of, an active reactor, you probably also see like the signature of, Gauss and PPCs and anything other.
Lasers too. They all use capacitors to bank their energy.
Well, I mean specifically electromagnets, the triggering of very powerful electromagnets that you'd see on something like a PPC for like channeling and forming the beam or bolt or whatever, or a Gauss rifle firing its acceleration rings to like catapult the projectile, that would probably trigger a massive magnetic field that you'd probably be able to see in something like mag scan vision or whatever.
I now want to know what a hag would look like firing in that vision mode, because that would have to be pretty nifty with the multiple barrels constantly
probably
going off so fast. That would be awesome. But you also, I am curious, because you mentioned capacitors, and we have that rule, PPC or Gauss capacitor, boom, explode, big damage. But don't PPCs also store a massive amount of energy in their capacitors until you fire them?
Like, rules wise, they're not volatile.
Yeah, but how? Why? What's the difference? Physically is the part I look at and I'm like, who hand waved that? I used to yell at Russ. I don't know if you ever saw me on the forums. I'm like, if you're going to put that mechanic on mechs and then give us the power up mechanic, then the stupid coil shouldn't explode if you're not powered up with your Gauss rifle and MWO, because you haven't charged the capacitors. Otherwise, if they're going to explode, they're ready to fire. Russ didn't like me for that.
To go back to your question about the spoon getting stuck to the side of the weapon. I mean, the further you are away, the less force there is to it.
For sure.
And that drops off exponentially, effectively. But I could totally see when you come off the battlefield and your tech is pulling everything apart to do maintenance, double check everything. There's just
there goes the wrench.
Armor. No, not there goes the wrench. They have to like physically take a leather glove and like scrape all the metal components that have been magnetized to the casing, which is now magnetized because it's been on your machine for 20 years and subjected to that magnetic field over and over.
Does he also have to use a non-ferrous set of tools to work on it at that point to keep his own tools from getting
stuck? He's powered it down and he's got a lockout device on it. You know, otherwise he's fried.
Electromagnets still be like magnetized after the current's not running through it, though?
Not the magnets, but isn't it the surrounding material that can become magnetized by the electromagnets?
That is correct. And this is super abstract. Like, this is not, like, every situation's different here. There are some electromagnets that are active only when electrical current is applied to them, and there's some that shut down, just like there's certain materials that expand and certain ones that contract when they're applied to electrical forces. Like, everything is a little different. There's always
science
an exception.
Stuff.
There's always an asterisk.
Now, we were, when I was chatting with Bruins a couple of times, we were talking about kind of how mechs move, because certainly he has to deal with that with his animation. I'm curious what, if you guys have thought, and it made me think, to coming out of that discussion and thinking about a bipedal mech moving at 120 plus miles per hour. I'm curious, you know, I'm sure someone who's better, who, you know, either better at biomechanics or an engineer that can kind of map it out and look at like a human sprinter and kind of what the proportional distance per stride is, you know, for a sprinter working at max pace, and then try to kind of extrapolate that to a battle mech to see exactly what that stride would look like. You know, what would a dasher stride, you know, with full, with mass gas activated going look like in terms of stride length? How close to like an Usain Bolt would it look like versus maybe like an Atlas running would be more like a sumo wrestler's, you know, kind of sprint, you know, type dynamic. And for like the guys like Bruins to figure out who's doing animation, like what does a mech actually look like when it's moving at different speeds, you know, versus, you know, whether it's bipedal or even the quads. It'd be interesting to see a quad running at, you know, 90 miles per hour.
One thing I think that we have to ignore is also scale of motion. Like, there's something they actually did really good in Pacific Rim. Mm-hmm. The longer the limb is, the heavier, the slower it moves through the arc regardless.
Yeah.
And so there is a hard finite limit that a bipedal human-sized machine that's built to human proportions could physically hit, no matter how big of the engine you put behind it. Eventually, those actuators can only move those legs so fast, which is why I, for giggles, designed a battle Zentradi battle pod based mech recently that does 38 hexes running. So 410 kph, 255 miles an hour. Physically impossible for a bipedal mech at 10 meters, 8 meters tall to do. Completely impossible.
Like,
but by the rules,
that starts to evolve into where you're almost like you're skipping almost to a degree. You know, it's kind of our long step. And like, if you see, you know, you'll see a track and field athlete, they'll do drills and they'll do kind of like a lunging stride, you know, something like that. And so at some point, you're going to have to go from like a traditional sprinting stride to actually you are look like you're constantly doing like a mini jump, horizontal mini jump every stride.
I'd flag that as a point where like the rules just kind of start to break down.
Break.
Just kind of like mechanical jump boosters can allow an Atlas to like Hulk jump across a battlefield if you just put all your tonnage into it and ignore everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah. And with Bruins, I mean, on his stuff, his style, it's really cool.
Yeah,
I think if he was to try to go relatively realistic, it would be a much more lumbering, no matter what they want to say. I'm not saying like, you know, walking tank, I do think that's a little too abstract a simplification. You could, I mean, as someone who used to run heavy equipment, skid steers, front end loaders and stuff, you'd be amazed the agility an experienced pilot can squeeze out of something like that. But that's not the same as Gundam agility. We're not talking about mechs doing Taekwondo and baby boot camp here.
Well, okay? I see it more as like, you know, you have been the, you know, going back to sprinters, you have sprinters that are like double amputees and they have the blades, you know, the carbon blades that they're running on. And so there's an adaptation there. There's a mechanical aspect to that. You know, I my instinct tells me, you know, and I don't know kind of the mechanical limitations and trying to move through the stride cycle, but that Bruins is, you know, seems a lot more realistic for the smaller mechs than say like, you know, harebrained schemes or something like that. You know,
I'd put him on the high end. It's still good. Don't get me wrong. I just say he's a little on the dynamic side, but for his style, that's where it should be also.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
But the blades are something I wish we'd see more of. I had designed an entry that I put in for a palladium power armor that never got picked up. But one of the things I had designed was a logical sprinting, jumping battle armor design would have like those blade style stilts mechanically attached to it. Yet those are ideas we've never seen investigated in a light battle armor and battle tech, something like a Sylph that had similar leg designs. I think would actually be a fascinating looking design, and it would mechanically make a hell of a lot of sense for something doing
that. There would be limitations though, because of ground pressure reasons. Not that there's like any actual rules for that sort of thing, but as you start like piling on weight, like you start risking stabbing into the ground. Although if your feet are too big,
the square has never stopped us before. Okay.
Yeah, I know.
But also to have the stilt blades, you don't have to have the tiny feet. That's used usually because it's advantageous for a human mass.
Yeah.
You could still use something similar and have a wider, almost snowshoe type foot on the bottom. Yeah. And in a lot of ways, like a mech like a Locust, having some intentional legs designed like that might be a way where it can slightly overcome the mechanical limitations of a straight mechanical leg design would be for top speed.
Yeah.
Just thinking outside the box when you mentioned the mechanics, the physics, the, you know, what goes into it. And yet instead we see chicken walkers, which mechanically are terrible to begin with. And other stuff are just, like things I've never understood. The Annihilator, 100 ton mech that gives 32 miles or 32 kph, has 70 plus tons of its mass above the weight, and yet every depiction it's all leg. You know, why is this mech all leg when those long legs serve no purpose at the speeds it moves? You know,
the thing to keep in mind is Battletech runs on Rule of Cool and Hand Wave, and trying to dig too deep into it is
that is the point of this.
I know that's exactly what we're doing.
We are the rule of overthinking things right here. That is the point of these.
I have no one would ever make a battle mech that's that big. It's not really practical, but
can we truly say Rule of Cool when you look at TRO 3055, 3058, 3060 though? Hand wave him, I'll agree. Rule of Cool is something Battletech's only traditionally had a passing acquaintance with.
Rule of Cool, relatively speaking.
It's a good thing we got off to a good start. And so it's like first impressions carries people through those later TROs.
But, oh my God.
Realistically, you'd probably never make a mech that is tall. Like, even if mechs were a thing, you probably wouldn't make one, you know, bigger than an IFV. At best, and that would probably
Votoms. Ever see Votoms?
Votoms.
The Votom anime? Size. That is a perfect example of a reasonable combat mecha.
What is that?
You know, it's a Japanese anime from the 80s called Votoms.
Okay.
Yeah. They're, I would say, 4.5-5 meters at tops on it. Basically, armored suit. They're largely disposable. I mean, the pilots get massacred constantly. They're not super agile, except for when they use a special move. They have basically like an actuated roller skate almost to give them better speed on ground, because the actuation is more akin to a realistic mechanism. That's actually one, you got to look it up. It's considered one of the fundamental, most realistic mecha cartoons ever made, using things like Myamer injection cylinders. Almost all the technology is stuff that was at least theoretically available or real at the time the cartoon was made. And so it's pretty fascinating when you look at a lot of stuff.
Fun fact, the roller skates. The roller skates were actually a technique for saving money on animation, actually.
But it became really cool. But it's Votoms. V-O-T-O-M-S.
Okay.
And I can send you a PM with that at some point, too. But for the listeners, to me, it's one of the largely lost gems. Everyone thinks Macross and New Rome, which are obviously foundation stones for mecha anime. But you start watching, and it's the stuff like, as bad as it was crapped on, even in the Robotech era, the Logan Veritech standing at all of 8 tons and I think 15 feet tall actually would make a logical combat mecha in size and agility in what it could do. A 40 foot tall, I mean, okay, you have the conceit, the Zentradi are 50 foot tall, so you're building something to match them in hand-to-hand combat for some reason, I guess. But realistically, it's kind of like the Pacific Rim thing. Giant monsters are coming through, so we build these giant robots to punch them instead of just firing really big missiles at them, calling it a day. it doesn't make sense to have mechs that big, but at all, like Alex said, I mean, anything over, I'd say, 6-7 meters tops is just a target. And there's something I could see. A quad design has some all-terrain capabilities, tracks, vehicles, hovercrafts could. I could see them as heavy lift carriers, artillery vehicles that are all-terrain. I could see a quad being used potentially for that. Frontline combat, no. But something that's a large power armor for special forces, I could see that being a major force multiplier, being able to ambush tanks, basically, with stuff that can give you the weapons and firepower, but with the agility, you know, of some level.
There's there's an anime called Obsolete. It's a series of, like, you know, these little mini episodes, but it basically explores that concept in terms of terms of mecha design. The suits are themselves, like, the whole premise of the plot is that a bunch of mysterious aliens show up and say that they'll give people of Earth technology for the low price of, I think, a certain amount of kilograms of limestone, which everyone's got just lying around, and they'll give you, you know, this robotic bipedal frame that all you need to do to pilot it is hold on to, like, this little ring on the back, and then the suit just behaves as if it's an extension of your body. And you see what it sees and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, most of the militaries of the world kind of poo-pooed the idea at first, but quickly, like, all the lower budget militaries just started essentially building, you know, armored housings over the thing because they couldn't improve on the base design, but they could improve on what goes on top of it. So you have, like, third world countries using, like, child soldiers where they basically put a tarp over the thing and give it an RPG, but then you've got, like, modern militaries that basically encase the thing with, like, the type of armor you'd see on an IFV and put cutting edge tech and, you know, all sorts of range finding equipment and life support and all this kind of crazy shit on it. But the underlying bones are all the same extremely cheap but high tech exosuit that no one could reverse engineer, but they just use as a template for building off of. And they're just very maneuverable. You know, the things are very easy to maintain because the aliens will just keep selling these things off in mass for everyone that could just mine limestone, which everybody's got limestone. So it creates all these sort of interesting geopolitical dynamics in the setting, and the anime just kind of the slice of life from, like, all these different perspectives, from, like, U.S. Special Forces versus, like, South American troops, versus, like, Central Africa troops, and, like,
Mexican drug cartel gearing something up for it.
Actually, there was one episode that dealt with coyotes doing, like, drug smuggling, you know, using, like, the exosuits, and a whole bunch of people press ganged into carrying the stuff on their own exosuits. The setting is very exosuit centric, naturally, but it's very interesting.
That was called, how they used them. What was that called? Obsolete? Is that
Obsolete? Yeah.
Obsolete. Is that what platform is that on?
You can find the episodes on YouTube.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought I saw it advertised on there. Yeah.
And then the the suit also has like this whole thing where like it's got a wheel on its butt and a pair of wheels on its knees. So it kind of does this weird crouch to turn into like a tripod, you know, scooter type dealie.
And now I just have an imagining one of a dog, you know, dragging its butt on the ground. You completely ruined the cool factor for me. That's all I got in my head. Is the exosuit dragging its butt on the ground like a dog with itchy bones?
I mean, kind of, yeah.
I was thinking other cheesy anime stuff, and you had to go to dog lips. Oh, my goodness. All righty.
Let's get back to nitpicking Battle Magazine.
I do think one thing I do wish was explored more in BattleTech, and I always advocate this, but, like, you know, it never gets any real traction, but I do think that it would, unfortunately for Mech Warrior games in general, it would probably add too much of an extra dimension to movement that it would kind of make the game hard to maneuver, especially between torso twisting and aiming your arms independently of your torso and stuff. But sidestepping, being able to laterally shift your mech, because if you've got the hip flexibility of being able to like halfway walk on an incline or getting up from a fall or surviving a jump jet landing, then you have the hip flexibility of being able to literally just juke or shift your mech, you know, laterally to some extent, where you're not always walking in the exact direction that your legs are pointing.
And that seems like a very easy edit to the tech readout. You know, it's just like, you know, it's two movement points to move, you know.
I mean, the rules support it. It's just not something that is
I'm actually going to slightly disagree with you on that a little bit, because there is a important difference between human movement and battle mech movement in that we're made of meat. Mm-hmm. Battle mechs are made of metal, and you're going to have less range of motion. And I absolutely agree that they would be able to, you know, do a little Cincinnati shuffle to the side. But
I'm not saying they should be dancing.
Yeah. but like, the way you're describing it, it sounds something like what they have the rules for quad mechs for the lateral.
Well, yeah, like basically quad mechs can spend two movement points to laterally shift.
Yeah.
It takes three movement points for a bipedal mech to basically approximate the same thing by like you know,
torso twisting, turn, moving, and yeah, then yeah, torso twisting back. Yeah.
Yeah.
But also those hexes are each 30 meters, and like mechs are tall, they're not super wide. They have a footprint of
what, maybe like, on 6 meters wide, yeah, 4 to 6, something like that.
Like, let's say 6x4.
I get that.
For the sake of argument.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, like, I don't really expect a like an Atlas to just be like side strafing, you know, like across a battlefield or anything like that. But like in terms of, say, you know, I walk my mech up to a building and I want to peek around the corner without having to do like the turn left, accelerate forward, reverse kind of thing like a tank would. You know, it'd be nice if I could literally just whoop, like take a step.
Are the rules? Do the rules
understand where you're coming from? I'm not disagreeing with you.
Do the rules still let you move backwards at the same speed as walking forward?
You just can't run backwards.
Depends on frame.
Right.
You know,
so you can walk backwards. So you can you can walk forward, you know, if you're a spider, you can walk forward what, you know, 240 meters. Eight. Or you can walk casually backwards 240 meters. I would like to see that. That's I think that
which is funny. That
should be probably two movement points to go back.
I do think it's kind of dumb that the rules don't let you reverse up hills. Like it makes sense that you can't reverse up super steep inclines, but just can't walk backwards up a gentle hill.
Yeah.
Down a slope just kind of seems a little weird.
Yeah. So double movement points to walk backwards, and maybe triple to move backwards up a gradual hill.
Yeah, something like that. There.
Well, on the topic of movement, jump jets, man. How does a jump jet get a mech 200 meters in the air and back down, you know, in 10 seconds? That's an interesting one to kind of play in your head. You know, you got to get the thrust to kind of, you know, break gravity, you know, first, and then you got to float and then you got to go. It's that doesn't quite work for your Highlander burials there.
Yeah, they are very efficient as far as tonnage to thrust ratio, aren't they?
Yes, definitely.
I'm going to say Space Wizards did it and not the Comstar or Word of Blake.
That one definitely doesn't hold up. But so Alex, you do a lot of, you know, I like the kind of the little accessories and whatnot that you add on your designs. And so, you know, what kind of essentials are there in a mech? You know, they're kind of your pulley systems. You know, do you always got to have a pulley system? What other things are kind of?
I mean, I like to throw on winches when I can. I like to add stuff like access panels where it would make sense. Like, you know, someone has to work on this thing, mm-hmm. so having areas where someone could remove a panel to like dig around in a leg or something like that, you know, just kind of makes sense. Vents to, you know, pump your heat out of. You know, little sensor doodads, because you probably don't want to be 100% reliant on cockpit glass and such. I guess indications of, you know, where armor might be thicker or where shells might be ejecting out of on autocannons or vents for missile launchers, stuff like that.
I don't know if you caught the in our the first podcast we did in this with Texan Bruins, is that we talked about LRM size, mm-hmm. and I was talking about how I kind of did the math, and essentially each LRM missile, you know, if you do the math, it's about the size of a mortar. It's about 15 kilos or 15 pounds. And I wonder if you've done that yourself and kind of. Because that essentially means that your LRM, like an LRM 20 pod, is very, it's like the size of this, you know, 4x6 table that I have my computer on right now.
Yeah, launchers in Battletech are grossly oversized.
Yeah, yeah.
Likely probably for rule of cool and being able to be visualized on a miniature scale.
You ever just sat down and drawn a mech and been like, rule of cool is out. I have to do this exactly how it would appear. You know, have you done that before? Like, you know, this is all the weapons would look like, have to look like this in order to be real. The LRM pods would, you know, LRM 5 would only be, you know, 4x4 feet.
Something did like you that. See my last urban mech I did with the 280? No. Well, okay, the one before that, the one that had like 280 rocket launchers.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah,
that was actually done approximately to real world scale of the Hydra 70, the M261 Hydra 70 pods, which in real life use 19.7 centimeter rockets instead of 10. Mm-hmm. But so I almost doubled the size of the rockets to go, well, Battletech has magic space armor that's tougher, so let's give it bigger. But we've done the math. Approximate size of an LRM is about the same as an RPG-7 grenade in length. And the proportions around might be a little different, not a big bulb up front. But that, to fit in there, would be about what you're looking at, which to me in some ways also explains why they do spitball damage individually.
Yeah. Well, most tiny. Of that, and most of that rocket is the propulsion. You know, probably 70-80% of that mass is propulsion. You
know,
That's being generous.
So question for you guys.
Yeah.
When we see the launchers on the miniatures or in the art, there's the tip is sticking out.
Mm-hmm. I hate that.
Yeah. So my headcanon for it is the launcher loads and then it slides forward into the firing position. So there's a little gap for the accelerant to build a buffer, you know, or to, you know, like prevent damage or what have you. What's your
or so
guys
that every time that? Somebody's medium laser hits your LRM pod, you don't have an ammo.
I honestly stopped trying to headcanon that because the only thing I can look at is that little cone you see.
Uh-huh.
Like there's a tiny little like Roman candle or something handle behind it, and it's only like extends that far into the rocket launcher tube or something. Because there's if you put the missile, like even the MWO the ones, if you watch slow motion breakdowns of MechWarrior Online and you see the individual missiles firing out, they're massive compared to the numbers they had. And I think the MWO ones are actually smaller by a fair number than most of the stuff depicted in the artwork goes. But it's, I had asked on that. Yeah, and some of it is, at, like Alex said, at 6mm scale, what would you see? I mean, everyone looked at that urban mech I did. They thought I did a bunch of miniguns on it because of the tiny little barrels with the little holes in it. Oh, that has to be machine guns. No, that's rocket launchers, you know? Yeah,
Just going by the amount of, going by the amount that you get per ton, your typical LRM, SRM, MRM, like the rocket pods themselves would be much, much smaller, much more compact. Probably most of the tonnage would just be, you know, the reloading system for those things and like whatever
and the magazine.
And the magazine, yeah.
Well, I mean, guidance, their guidance is worse than what we have today. So,
guidance is horrible.
I do think one of the things that probably should have never gone Lost Tech to begin with, or actually, I don't even think it was ever Lost Tech. It was just created for Solaris later, but Thunderbolt missiles make total sense to have always been around because, you know, while it's nice to be able to have the option of spamming something with a bunch of little crappy rockets like a hydropod, you know, having something equivalent to a Hellfire missile or, you know, anti-tank guided missile or something like that.
It sure would be nice to have this mech that's in the field attacking a bunker have a bunker buster.
Wasn't the lore fluff behind that or explanation because the single larger missile was much easier for anti-missile systems and countermeasures to destroy, so the spamming the big cloud of smaller stuff was more likely and cheaper to have because you weren't guiding it. And I mean, it doesn't make sense. No, but
but then AMS became Lost Tech.
Yeah,
true. But so did guidance at that point, apparently, for some dumb reason.
Yeah.
I mean, and you're talking about Thunderbolts, which are one of my favorite weapons, despite being not that well done. But it also drives me nuts. You see the Thunderbolt launchers, and hey, you see them, and they actually usually are depicted as a single missile poking out or something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we see an Arrow 4 launcher, and for some reason, there are always 3 to 5 missile slots with missiles sticking. And you're like, what? It only shoots one. What? And if there's a load mechanism, why would it have multiple? You know? Again, consistency just kind of like hurts the brain when you look at some of that stuff.
You're assuming that the artist had all of the lore information when they were given the task. I am not an artist, so I can't say it whether that happens or not, but I'd be surprised.
Not usually.
Many of those old illustrations were done for literally $50.
And let's also remember one thing, whether artist or game developer, 90% of them honestly have no background with weapons of any sort. Which is why we see so vast misunderstandings on even simple things like handgun calibers and how they work and what power scales up and stuff. And you just read the most rules and you go, okay.
Yeah, most of us aren't experts.
I mean, I'll admit, I'm overly fascinated with military weapons, guns, and all that. And there's definitely people way more knowledgeable than I am. But it's like, if that's what my conceit's going to be, I'm doing a military combat game. Mm-hmm. I'm going to want to do a little research, which admittedly in the 80s, you didn't have Google. You didn't have the internet, you know? And I don't know if you've ever seen the old Jane's information guides that people used. Those were expensive as crap to get the stuff that had all the information on actual weapons. And most of the stuff you bought on the street that wasn't that was so wildly inaccurate on all the details. It was ridiculous. But at the same token, you could still see, like, anyone who served in the military and picked up an M16 and read the personnel weapons in MechWarrior 1 or Shadowrun would just be like, oh, my God, what the heck? you know.
Well, I mean, in the lore, they have the flechette pistol, which is supposed to carve its projectiles off a solid block and then shoot them.
Yeah.
How?
The spitting toothpick gun. Yes.
Yeah.
I remember those.
And how? And plastic, how much mass is it going to have after it? I mean, after what, maybe 5 feet, you're going to have so little mass on those, they're going to bounce off anything. Now, I could see a possibly, if you had something that could shave it, like tungsten flechettes?
Yeah.
Oh, would at least keep enough mass? But yeah, well, just the whole concept. How do you get it to shave? I admit. What's the propellant? What's causing it to go forward? But then there were some stuff I liked, like, was it Bill Keith in the Decision on Thunder Rift actually described a vibroblade that made sense. It's not that it was, oh, look at this, it's a chainsaw. It's vibrating enough where it heats the blade up from friction, and that's what lets it cut more.
Yep.
But then we suddenly get mech-sized vibroblades for some ungodly, stupid reason when there's no way the mechanism, A, would scale to that, or B, survive a single impact against another machine.
Yeah.
And you're just like, when they, well, it's just, that's when they jumped the shark in the mid-90s, because the thing that was, what, during the second wave of anime, basically, just before Evangelion and all that got big, suddenly you got the katana, you got the flail, you got retractable Wolverine claws, and you're just like, what the hell happened here?
So, okay, I actually think the, like, retractable claws are salvageable as a weapon system, but you just have to retool it as I'm sliding a piston forward, punching, it disengages or ejects, and then a new one slides out. You know, you got like three shots.
Like razor cartridges, and I could see them also more if they were spikes, like combine some of the lance mechanics with retractable blade. Yeah. And that would make sense. I mean, you punch and it breaks off.
Nothing should be slashing. It should all be penetrative. Like that, like flashing, it's a giant metal machine.
I mean, the gadget semi works because it's not really slashing. It's a bludgeon that just has a plain end. It's still crushing. And I'm okay with mech maces, but once you get to swords, retractable blades, vibro blades, mech flails, mech spikes, okay, I have spiky shoulder pads on my mech so that if you run into me, you take damage. What?
There's that there's that Solaris mech that has the crown of spikes to protect it, you know?
So, oh, isn't it like a Turkish variant or something?
Yeah,
there's that one from the Tiro Bandits or Pirates or some crap, and then you have Aqua Gladius that has like a crane arm with a flail and a bunch of spikes on its back, and you're like, oh, what happened? Where did BattleTech just start going insane?
Legitimately, I would like to see a lot more industrial mechs, and I'm not talking Dark Age stuff with people strapping weapons to them. I am not asking for that. That was cool for a very small period, a very small window. We played with it and we've moved on. But like just in the background, having worker mechs around makes total sense because you have all that scaled infrastructure already.
No, I love industrial mechs.
I think the rules for the pile driver are woefully under, like, that thing should be so much cooler for how much it weighs and what it should be capable of. Because all it is I'm paying, like, AC-20 tonnage and, like, sacrificing a bunch of actuators just to be able to punch like a 90 ton mech, regardless of what the weight of the mech is. Like, I feel like if I mounted one of these on a 90 ton mech, I should be getting something out of it, like going Big O style or whatever. I don't care if it's practical at that point. I want to be able to, like, you know, punch something with a giant impact hammer.
And why would I use that when I can make a 45-ton mech with a mace and quadruple-strength Miamers that hits harder by the current rules? There's so many things. I look at the rules, and I'm like, how can I justify it? Like, mech mortars. I want to use mech mortars. Then I read the rules and I'm like,
kind of suck.
And I'm taking the mech mortars off this design because I just can't justify how bad they are. And honestly, that's the same with any artillery. And people try to justify it. And I'm like, dude, how much tonnage are we investing in a long tom? And yet it's a spit wad, essentially, in comparison. And if you're not using like a full battalion of artillery to hit an area, it's a joke. I mean, Arrow 4s are cool, but everything else is basically garbage for the tonnage.
So I haven't had a chance to play with a lot of artillery on the tabletop, but to me, and reading the rules, for it to be effective, you really have to scale it up. And unfortunately, playing tabletop IRL doesn't scale up well because of the time constraint.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of one of those, like, catch-22s.
Yeah, and the other drawback is the mechs are supposed to be king of the battlefield, and so if off-map guns are too powerful, that takes the rule of fun away from playing the mech, too, which is what also tends to get infantry and vehicles and all that stuff pooched so often. I mean, they're better now than they used to be, but still, there's so little focus on making the combined arms interesting, and part of it's the how do you do it without taking away from the central conceit of the game, which is mechs.
Yeah. Difficult, but once they figure it out, I'll be happy because I want more battle armor.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm the guy who, as much as I hate the visuals of them, I love the concept of proto mechs.
Yeah.
I think they're
a
really cool idea, and I would love to see Interseer versions. Now, obviously, you're not having the Compelling Confederation or Draconis Combine might have the Drive You Insane enhancement stuff with it because they're Capellans and Curitans. But, you know, you'd have to have a simplified, more analog cockpit of something. So maybe you have instead of a 1-ton cockpit module, I have to put a 2-ton cockpit module into an Interseer Proto. Or, I don't know. And then just don't steal all the art from the old D&D monster manuals and actually make them look sensible, and I think they'd be super cool, because most of the people I talk to, the biggest complaint, other than, but they take away from mechs, or battle armor is actually stronger because of the having the armor distribution, there's most proto mechs I can kill for less damage than I can a suit of battle armor, but also, they look stupid.
They do.
Because
that's my complaint.
Robot with a scobra head running around, or one that's looking like a harpy, or a warthog, and you're like, I don't want to speak bad of the dead, because Chafee did most of them, but I have no idea, and I don't know what it is. Maybe the bosses told them to, but they're horrible.
I mean, there's just certain things that shouldn't get mashed together. I love Eldritch Horror. I don't ever want to see a mech inspired by an Eldritch Horror creature from beyond.
Play Cthulhu Tech if I want that.
It would there's translate.
Yeah, I'll play Rifts or Cthulhu Tech and do that. I don't want that. Honestly, Traveler. I hate totem mechs as a general, not as an entire concept, like the Nova Cat for Clan Nova Cat's fine. No offense to your Kodiak, by the way, Alex, but when you have a 100-ton Care Bear or a My Little Pony mech.
It does go against the whole idea of clans of poor waste. Why would they be going out of their way to make
And almost all of them are for the second line to begin with. So you're going to all this extra expense for your totem mech, but because it's not an omni mech, your frontline warriors won't use your totem mech until the ghost pairs apparently love Kodiaks regardless, which, I mean, they do kick butt, so I don't blame them. But this, just all the big birds and the My Little Ponies, and I was like, no, and I don't want samurai mechs, and especially samurai mechs with pig stickers.
I am going to get on the soapbox here for a second. I want to point out, from the Kickstarter, I got a Jade Falcon coin. I love the Jade Falcon. What they did to them in the Dark Ages with those totem mechs.
Oh, with all the claws and wings and stuff?
No.
Abomination!
The worst, though, the worst, was the weapon systems that had the clip with the window.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know why they didn't do those after World War I? Because they clogged
everything. Because they jam.
Yes. It's
a Show Shop magazine. Yeah. That's the first thing I saw when I saw that. And you're like, That, and how about I have partial wings that have feathers, so there's actually no lift surface on these partial wings? What the heck? The stupid, those wings, I hate them so bad because they make zero freaking sense.
As a heat sink, I get the concept, but you don't spread them out. You spread them back.
Back.
Gooseneck style.
And also, you're not going to get lift from that style of wing.
No,
call it partial heat sink system. But yeah. A wing, now, is it the OSCAL-2C that has the actual, like, kind of like the Kage style battle armor wing behind it, where it's actually got a couple flat airplane style wings behind its chassis. I don't know if I'd see it actually giving it more jump distance, but I could see it helping as a control surface with the mech be more maneuverable at least. And again, maybe some cooling.
Yeah.
I could see. But like the Jade Falcon ones, I was just like, WizKids, I mean, these are the ones that gave us the anorexic Atlas with spike pads. So, I mean.
It literally looks like someone took an Atlas with some Play-Doh and made spikes on it. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It's bad.
Give me that maybe in the TRO Pirates as a one-off Bandit King half-scrapped Atlas somewhere in the periphery. Yeah. I'd accept that. Okay. It's supposed to be a walking junk pile that intimidates people still because it's still an Atlas compared to what everyone else has. But,
all right. Well,
a Davian frontline unit? No.
All right. Let's pull off of what's bad here. Oh my gosh. What do these things think they're creating for $50 for 3 hours worth of work? I mean, come on, these artists. But let's go. There was one thing.
Never trust artists.
Right.
Never trust them.
We touched on before we hit the record button, and I wanted to kind of go through kind of what different mechs look like coming from different manufacturers. And we had touched on this in my one-on-one talk with Alex about, and we were talking about kind of the difference between the unseen and kind of the new mechs, and just how they could all exist. It's just a matter of material manufacturing was more advanced. When the Griffin was made, and so you had a lot smoother, mech, and it's just a lot more kind of plates, and kind of, welded onto the mech at this time, and so now it looks kind of more of kind of the more blocky square. I'm curious, if you guys, thought, or, Bishop, with your wide range of all the different manufacturers and all the different systems of kind of, have you thought about how, a common mech probably built everywhere, maybe like a Centurion or something, what's the Centurion look like depending on where it's built and how those vary in the manufacturers?
Some I would say like possibly Wolverines or Wasps or something that's built almost everywhere would probably look largely similar, because part of it is you look at tanks that are exported to different parts of the world.
Yeah.
They're largely the same thing. You might see mild differences, but I don't know if you're going to see a lot, because if they're exported to different places, unless each independent faction is using their own, with the M1 tank and the, forget what the British tank's called, but they use the Chobham armor, whereas the Merkava for Israel does not use Chobham armor.
Well,
and so you do see some proprietary tech in that way.
Right. Well, you're also magnifying over the course of hundreds of years and several centuries versus modern, where it's like maybe a decade or two, difference between, when this person that person is building it. And a lot of it, I imagine,
but it's
from stolen plans and they reverse engineer it, based on whatever their manufacturing ability is and how different that would be. Now, whenever I put miniatures on the table, I try to get like one of each kind of miniature. One of my about playing with the miniatures is having like four of the exact same Griffin sculpts on there. I was like, I want one of each Griffin sculpt, and so they at least look
for me. I think it would break down though to which era more than even which manufacturer in a lot of ways, because one of the examples is Project Phoenix. One of the excuses for the extreme change in so many is like this mech was redesigned to use ferrofibrous armor that it originally didn't have, and so that changed its physical outline. So if you have a primitive era Warhammer, versus a Starleague era Warhammer. I expect to see the Warhammer at the more modern era to have a more streamlined armor. But then when you add Pharaoh to it again, because of the limitations, Pharaoh houses more blocky armor, supposedly, you might see that become blockier again. But unless the actual, like, what is the armor on the base 6R Star Shield? If every 6R out there is being built to the same spec because they're all being built by the same basic company, then those are going to have the same. Whereas possibly now if you're talking the, say, 6D Davion version, well, obviously not only is it going to have some difference, but it also has almost, what, 40% more armor? So there should be a physical difference there, obviously, on that. But I'm just saying, like, an Archer 2R that's built by the same company and just sold to different clients, I don't think you're going to see massive changes unless there is an inherent change. Now, let's say you have a bunch of Archer 2Rs, the 4M comes online. Do you update all your 2Rs to the same armor spec to keep logistics there? Now, that is a good question from real-world standpoint, because that's obviously what we see a lot of things done in military vehicles. It's updated to the M1A, so they send out that armor package to all the tanks in there, so their armorers, the logistics quartermasters, don't have the hassle. But if there's not that kind of change in it, I don't see why just having it specifically an Archer in, at House Merrick or House Davion, if they're both 2Rs from the same company, I don't see why there'd be much, if any, physical difference. Now, when they rebuild them out of their own armor supplies, you might start seeing differences because they might not be getting armor from the same manufacturer as the original Archer came from. And
yeah, I see.
A more faction-specific mech, obviously that's where I see the biggest difference. You definitely would see more visible differences in a Dragon and Panther design versus a Valkyrie or a Hatchetman because of the different techniques of the cultures.
I see. I feel like the internals are going to be fairly consistent, but the externals kind of are going to change over time. Get a little bit less rounded, a little bit more blocky. But
I think you'd probably see a lot of drift, especially like over some of these chassis that are like physically hundreds of years old, not just the actual design, but like some of these mechs literally are that old. Like there was a short story compilation I picked up at Gen Con, like, I don't know, a few years back, that was just a collection of short stories that all involved the same grasshopper the point where it was built to like the point where they stuffed it in a museum somewhere for being extraordinarily old. And it just went from like different pilot, it end up abandoned somewhere, like, you know, in a desert, found again, showed up somewhere else, fought like in all these different conflicts. But like, I would imagine, like if you were constantly putting this thing back together over and over and over again, some of these older chassis would probably experience a lot of drift from the original specs. Maybe not so much the ones that are fresh off the factory, they would probably.
That's my point.
So yeah, I feel like you highlight the true heroes in the BattleTech universe. It's not the Kais. It's not the, you know, it's not whoever, you know, it's not the Victors. It's the techs. Techs that keep these things running for 400 years.
Read the Tales of the Black Widows. There's a whole scenario in there about stealing a bunch of texts for Michael Hasek Davion because texts are like rare as gold in the Succession Wars, you know? And I totally agree with Alex on the patchwork armor, the older mechs. I mean, it's the story of your grandfather's axe. How many times have you replaced the handle, then you replaced the head, and it's not even really the same axe. But at the same token, coming off the manufacturer line, that would be largely a different story. I mean, and you might see differences throughout years, like a shortage of something might cause a specific run to have to use a different manufacturer of armor, for instance. But that's also, and that's one of the fun things why it's so easy to say, hey, I have this miniature and it's still okay to use. because it's just that. But trying to quantify it outside of large systemic changes on the chassis is just, as we've said about most things when it comes to physics and BattleTech, that way lies madness.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it would be really, like, okay, so what we're talking about here has two categories. I think we have the repair drift, which happens, you know, with the grandfather's axe and as everything is repaired. But there's also, like, the difference in off-the-line standard, which is what Travis is, I think, really wanted to talk about. And I think we would see, actually, a lot of variation at the very beginning, and then over time it would start to narrow back into a single design. But we're talking about things like, it's designed on Hesperus II, it's built by Defiance Industries, but it's also subcontracted to Coventry. Mm-hmm. Well, the shop foreman gets the plans and goes, you know, like, oh, I actually can't make this part the way you want me to because my tools can't get in there the way you want them to. So the guy in Hesperus 2 walks over to the office of the engineer and goes, what do we do? The guy on Coventry, he's got to figure it out himself. So they're going to be different solutions. Eventually, once everybody talks, they'll figure out the best one and that'll become standard. But I think we'd see a lot of really cool finite little changes that you could like pin down where this mech originally came from, what factory or even what era, but there's no way to quantify that in the rules. That's just a complete lore thing.
Yeah, we're just shooting on like headcanon and lore here.
I would imagine, you know, you'd probably have, you know, some aesthetic flares or like some minor like adjustments. For example, like people throwing cowls on the Cyclops to help cover up the weak head, or you know, probably like Curitans putting their flags or putting their samurai doodads on their armor. Yeah, like I would imagine if these things are like being put back together a few times, or if they're like, you'd also have to some extent like local workshops. Like, for example, if you're familiar with Khyber Pass firearms by any chance.
Mm-hmm. Oh yes.
Like there's like some region called the Khyber Pass that they are famous for their gunsmiths, that they basically, to varying degrees of quality, try and copy existing firearms or like jury-rig them together or whatever, and you end up with stuff that looks barely better than your average zip gun, all the way to stuff that looks like a perfect replica of like some expensive firearm.
Martini Henry, for instance, yeah.
Yeah. Some stuff becomes like a tradition to make, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. But like, I would imagine if you've got like an inner sphere that is thousands of light years wide, lots of planets, lots of country, like provinces within those planets, and all these workshops across, you know, ridiculous amounts of space, that you probably have like a number of regional differences, because who's going to bother trying to call Hesperus when you need something now? So like, I need this armor fixed yesterday. I need to make this arm function. I need to get this actuator functional. You know, I don't care what the CEO of Defiance thinks. You know, get the foreman on the workshop floor to fix this arm now with whatever's necessary.
You don't have the part, make the part.
Yeah.
You know, well, wasn't that the conceit of the Third Succession War?
Yeah.
I mean, basically everything, like you said, was jury-rigged that way. That was, which makes sense there.
I mean,
during the Clan Invasion era?
Like, chargers during the Third Succession War that had all the big engines torn out and actually, like, downgraded.
Like the Challenger model and stuff, but, then, even I'm thinking you have like some manufacturing companies like GM or Ford where everything's built to X spec. But I don't know if anyone's familiar with the old International company, but they used to build a vehicle called the Scout. And literally, depending on what month and what day of a given month, you would have a different headlight installed from the factory on that same International Scout. Hmm. So, like, 1974 International Scout doesn't mean anything. You could have 8 different headlights that were used, depending on when the dumb thing was built. So I get that. When I start to struggle with it, which, I mean, I have to ignore the fact we have 500 base chassis to begin with. But where it comes down to, if you start drifting too much, at least during the higher tech times, logistics becomes even there's a reason you can't modify the armor on an OmniMech, because now the OmniPort doesn't fit the OmniPod anymore. And that, to a lesser degree, also applies to your normal mechs. If you start having all these small variations across your army, it starts becoming very hard to maintain and keep them up. And Third Succession War, yeah, everything was jury-rigged. Like you said, it's Bob's mech has a Clint left elbow actuator on his archer or whatever, you know, because that's what you had to work with. And so on that era, definitely variation. But, like, if you look in the Star League era, you look at the Clan Invasion era to the Fedcom Civil War, I don't see it really making a lot of sense where they'd have that kind of variation, because they have the technical capacity, unless you're in the Astrocase or places like that in the periphery, to manufacture to spec. And as long as you can manufacture to spec, you make logistics less of a nightmare. And that's why, even if it's harder to get part X in a major military, you don't just use part Y. You wait till you get part X and you take that unit offline if need be until you get the proper part, because you end up with the band-aids and it becomes a technical nightmare to maintain. And so that's where I don't know if I'm fully on board outside of the Third Succession War with the full patchwork menagerie, I guess.
I would argue that you'd probably see more standardization on, like, the regiments that are getting moved around a whole bunch. Like, if your bottleneck is basically drop ships, then it stands to reason that you probably definitely need to get everything all squared away, minimal amount of waste, you know, maximum amount of, like, cross compatibility if everything's being shoved into a dropship and you have to physically cart everything from point A to point B, some other star system away. You want to make sure everything's working. You don't have the luxury of having, like, the patch of misfit toys type approach to mechs. But at the same time,
even,
like,
customs. Yeah.
It's also a question of resources, too, because, you know, if you're talking about the Royal House units, yeah, they're going to have enough resources because it's in the defense budget. If we're talking about Joe Schmo mercenary who's taking contract to contract to survive.
Oh, yeah, that's a different story completely. And even militias and garrisons within the big houses. If you have a mech in, like, House Davion Brigade of Guards, then it's becoming patchwork. Most of those mechs are actually still owned by House Davion, not by the individual warrior. And so if you got a patchwork mech and you have to rotate that brigade to the front, they're going to take whatever good mechs the local militia garrison has and put their patchwork quote mechs with the militia and go forward with the logistically sound machines. That's just how the major military arms work. Like you said, mercs, though? Yeah, mercs are grab bag. Militia's going to be a bit of a grab bag. The richer ones will have more consistency. The poorer ones, less. You get into the periphery, less. You get into completely backward worlds that the house lords forget they own.
You're going to have less.
Leave my Chaos March alone, darn it.
It's a grab bag. You want it, it's there. That's what I'm saying.
Well, that's why I had a legion of urban mechs built on Valkyrie chassis and urban mech components slapped together because, you know, there was a bunch of Davion and Capellan scrap in their Chaos March.
But yeah, like, I kind of think that if you've got regiments that are, say, underfunded or, like, stationary for long periods of time, basically the stuff that hasn't moved from, like, the planet that it's currently on for a number of years, you're going to get probably more regional drift on those than you would the ones that are like being constantly moved around from battlefield to battlefield, because there's less pressure on the ones that are stationary to, you know, be compatible with everything else. There's less incentive there. There's more incentive to keep it functional with what's nearby than there is to have the cross compatibility with everything else. Granted, as soon as a major invasion force is happening and that garrison or whatever that's sitting there has to suddenly work together with a whole bunch of other stuff, then you're going to see more of that incentive there. And heck, if you've got a long-standing battlefield or a long-standing conflict between two opposing forces, you're even probably going to see some pressure to be able to use enemy ammo, enemy parts as well, because that's a resource that you could be taking advantage of. So
it happens.
Other question, would you be seeing oftentimes, like you're talking about with the stationary units, one of the reasons you might also see those Franken-mech'd more is as the frontline units go, if you have to repair your frontline unit's archers and there's an archer in the stationary unit, you'll strip parts from that militia to go to that frontline mech. And so now they're filling in, okay, what do I put my knee actuator? How do we replace that on this mech in the, you know, back?
You know, there can be a lot of cannibalization probably going on.
I mean, another question is, you know, how many upgrade kits is said factory producing a year, and who do go to first?
Very much.
Like, I'm sure there are like militia units that are waiting on 3 or 4 upgrade kits.
And there's a reason you'd probably never realistically see something like a Clint in the Davion Brigade of Guards, because you can't get the bloody gyro for the thing. So if they have that, they're going to assign that mech to a militia and move something from the militia up in its place on the brigade, because
it belongs in
it's a liability. You know, I mean, realistically, there's just some mechs that, rule of cool, of course, if I want to play an assassin, I want to play an assassin no matter what unit I'm in. But if we're thinking about it realistically, who would, especially with the tiny cockpit? I mean, you know, use that or a mech. I mean, my assassin actually has a family of lineage of horse jockeys, and that's why he's able to pilot his assassin without a problem, because he's 5 foot tall. I mean, outside of that, you look at some of these things like, man, there's no way this would be in a frontline unit ever, even in the worst of the succession wars.
Yeah,
it's a unique and special snowflake, and and trying to maintain it would be a nightmare. Yeah.
Yep.
We were talking about the Scorpion on my podcast and some of the art on the later ones, and we're just like, that thing's huge. You have a sleepaway cab back there.
Well, you've seen the animated series, the finale episode where they're fighting inside the summoner cockpit, and like it looks like a studio apartment. Too funny.
Please don't remind me of why I hate that cartoon so bad. Please don't remind me. I'm trying to respect all the work that you guys put in to bring it to life by not remembering it.
Just watch episode 11.
It's bad propaganda. That's all you have to remember. Oh,
goodness. So bad. So bad on everything.
All right. Well, for those, I'm kind of turning into a pumpkin here, but we've got a good 2 hours of talking about Max. So let's wrap it up there. But, thanks a lot, guys.
Right.
Give a shout out to everybody, where to find everybody. So Brent is on the Origin of Battle Mechs. He is on iTunes, Spotify, all the podcast platforms, and recently YouTube. So that's even a new one.
Nice.
So pick him up on YouTube. And then we got Bishop Steiner on Patreon, on Twitter. Mainly go to Patreon. Support the man. And then we got Alex Glacius, Flying Debris on DeviantArt. Are you on ArtStation, Alex?
No, I should be, though. I'm just really disorganized.
Hey, you and me both.
Yeah. I'm on Twitter, too, I guess.
Cool. All right.
Yep.
Twitter.
Yeah.
Connect with Alex.
And you can find me.
Flying Debris on Twitter. Is that your tag there, too? Flying Debris Guy, isn't it?
Yeah, Flying Debris Guy. Yeah. All
right. Yeah. And then, of course,
if folks want, they can find me on DeviantArt too. FYI. Yeah. that's where most of my artwork is.
Well, not most of it. Most of it's on Patreon. You got to pay for the good stuff, right?
The new stuff is on Patreon. Eventually, it'll work its way there.
Fair.
And if you want to yell at me for making fun of your favorite mech, you can find me on most of the BattleTech Facebook pages at any time.
Excellent. And you can find Renegade HPG on YouTube primarily, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, all those fun things, and of course Patreon as well if you want to support the channel. But thanks everyone for joining us. Thank you to my guests. And we'll get you guys together in new configurations for more crazy talks in the future. And so, that's it. This is Travis signing off. Thanks, everyone.